There is no alternative to soul.
On Sunday, September 16th at 11 p.m., Sugar My Bowl presents Mr. Soul, Ellis Hazlip and the Birth of Black Power TV, with filmmaker and niece Melissa Hazlip. Mr. Soul will be featured at this year's Urban World Film Festival. That's Sunday, September 16th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. Listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. My name is Joyce Jones, and our guest for this evening is producer, director of Mr. Soul, Ellis Hazlip, and the Birth of Black Power TV, Melissa Hazlip. Melissa Hazlip is also the niece of Ellis Hazlip. And Mr. Soul will be screening at two locations on September 21st. It will be screening as part of the Urban World Film Festival. And on October 6th, it will screen as part of the Real Sisters of the Diaspora Film Festival and Lecture Series. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl starting now.
My soul. I want some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar in my bowl.
More than a star, there is power in although it's over, so it's not the end. Black seeds keep on growing. Keep on growing. There is no alternative to soul. Soul. Keep on growing.
Do you know who you are? Oh.
Although it's over, it's not the end. Black seeds keep on growing. There is no alternative to soul.
That soul will be included in the television history of this decade when things go down. But because I hadn't seen enough images of myself, I watched, should some unaware group of people take soul off, I won't see black people creating, searching, and acting instead of reacting.
That program was so beyond its time that it was in time.
And the moment that went on that television, it went boom. You know, we're back.
I just had images of blacks all around the country saying, yes, yes, tell them yes.
Black voices speaking to the problems of our time.
This is serious business. Our lives were at stake.
There exists, as far as I know, no TV program that deals with my culture so completely, so freely, and so beautifully. There is no alternative to soul.
Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with
Melissa Hazlip.
Melissa Hazlip, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl. I'm so glad to have you here.
I'm so happy to be here. We've been talking about doing this for a long time.
Yes, we have. And I wanted to start off by saying we opened the program, in addition to the trailer, with, I guess, what would be considered, correct me if I'm wrong, the New York area radio premiere of Where's Your Soul? By Robert Glasper. Is that correct?
That is correct. And I'll just have to say, when it's called Show Me Your Soul.
Thank you. And so it will be considered a Robert Glasper release, yes?
Yes. This is a brand new song that was written for our film specifically, with the wonderful Layla Hathaway in mind to sing the lead on the song. And she is fantastic. So Grammy winning, Robert Glasper wrote the music, and it's really fantastic. We're going to release the song when the film is released, for the theatrical premiere, so that we can share the song and maybe tease it a little bit earlier than that. So you're very lucky to be able to hear it. Most people can only hear it if they're in the audience. And there is another writer on the song as well. His name is Muhammad Ayers, and he is a fantastic young singer, songwriter, composer, producer out of Louisiana, who wrote the lyrics and some of the melody.
Has he recorded with Glasper before?
He has, on the Robert Glasper Experiment Black Radio 2, which came out in 2014.
So how did you come upon deciding that Robert Robert Glasper would provide the music for the film.
Robert Glasper is a genius, just an amazing musician, songwriter, composer, just really daring and just so new and fresh with his ideas. And I had a really clear vision of what I wanted the music to be like. Musically, I knew that Robert Glasper had done this amazing job on the soundtrack for the Miles Davis movie called Miles Ahead.
Right.
And he'd just worked with all these wonderful musicians, and I just thought, I love his sort of neo-soul, R&B, and jazz vibe that is so completely unique and eclectic and referencing all the past geniuses and brilliant folks that music is really built upon. But he also has a completely fresh take, and he works and collaborates with all these wonderful, great artists, and I thought, that's the perfect person who could sort of bridge the gap, has a firm grip on classic R&B and soul and jazz, and totally gets it, and having just done the Miles Davis soundtrack, and by the way, he did win the Grammy for that,
right,
for Best Compilation Soundtrack, I thought, wow, I'd already been a huge fan of his. Wouldn't it be great to work with somebody like that? So we got together, and he came and checked out the cut while we were editing it, and you know what? He actually started composing right on the spot.
Wow.
He excused himself. He got up abruptly and went outside of the edit bay where we were watching the cut, and it looked like he was on the phone. I thought, oh, he must have gotten a phone call really quick, and he just stepped out so he wouldn't be impolite. But you know what? He was actually singing into his phone.
Wow.
So he was so inspired by what he saw that he started singing. He started hearing it already. That stayed with me. This was the time when we were sort of just coming up with musical ideas and themes, and the music was going to be so important to the film. So that just blew me away that he would be so inspired that he would just compose on the spot. So I'll never forget that. That was just really cool.
He really did a great job, because it's very, very seamless. I can't tell the difference between the music that you had to get rights for, which we'll talk about later, and what he composed himself for the film. So he really did a great job.
Absolutely. And that was the real key. I always felt like, and I expressed this to Robert when I first met him, I said, you know, the music is a character in our film. Mm. Just like there are other characters and people who are real and people who are famous and celebrities and musicians and amazing bands and legends of music and R&B and icons of our culture, the music itself is like a character. So I wanted to make sure that it would be in the right hands of someone to develop that character, nurture that character, and give that character its own story arc from the beginning, middle to the end. And I know that sounds a little heady and kind of esoteric, but that's really how I looked at it. The through line of the music was just as important as the through line of the culture, the movement of the people that we're telling, you know, and the biography of the man and the biography of the show, the soul show.
A similar thing seemed to be in play during Eyes on the Prize. The music was important as well as what was happening in the story of a civil rights movement.
Absolutely. Sam Pollard worked on that.
Right.
And I think that the music was key, because the thing about Eyes on the Prize is that it really represents the journey of a people and the movement out of struggle and into agency and freedom. Mm-hmm. And our music as a culture has always mirrored that journey. And we all have our own personal soundtracks, but also the soundtrack sort of completely mimics, if not embodies, that journey of a people across the diaspora, across generations, and across migrations from the South to the North and the East to the West. And so we really wanted the music in Mr. Soul to be representative of this transformational time, both in culture and in art for Black people, and the perception of Black people and the perception of Black culture.
Happy anniversary, by the way, to Soul. It's rather fortunate,
yes,
that Ellis Hazlip mentioned the date during the course
he
of the
sure
series.
He sure did. In the last episode of the show, Ellis Hazlip has a profound quote, and he says, Soul taped its first performance on September the 8th, 1968. We began the route of documenting our own history because we knew from what we were seeing in the media and from what we were hearing from the people that Soul will go down in television history when things go down.
Right.
I'm not sure if I got that quote exactly right, because I'm saying it from memory from 10 years of listening to it.
That's very close if you didn't.
That's pretty close.
I think he also, at the end, he says how we actually opened our promo. There's no alternative.
No alternative to Soul. And he says it in that classic Ellis Hazlip voice that nobody had any clue where he came up with that accent. But his unique stamp, there is no alternative to Soul. I think it really placed him uniquely out in front as a personality at a time when we really didn't have Black personalities on television, let alone Black people on television. So unbeknownst to him, he was creating a brand at a time when we really needed someone to lead us, to sort of give us an opportunity to think differently about ourselves and what the possibilities would be for us out there in the world.
As I've prepared to get ready to talk to you, I'm reminded of the first time I actually met you was during a Kickstarter launch party in Harlem for Mr. Soul.
Yes.
And it was September 24th, 2012, to be exact. And in noticing that, though, I noticed you had actually been working on the film 2 years before.
You know, we actually, the concept for the film was born in 2008. We shot, and we had to, of course, start raising money, and we had to raise funds and awareness and put a trailer together and a little bit of a fundraising trailer to have a presence in the world. So we started all of that a long time ago. In total, it's about 10 years.
Wow. So that Kickstarter party actually included one of our former programmers, Andrea Clark, as the DJ.
Absolutely. Everyone who's had a hand on this film, we have been so grateful for. It takes a village, not only to raise a child, but to make a film. Because it's not about one person, and it certainly hasn't been about me. This has been about the movement. It's for the culture. It's for the people. And there have been so many hands who have helped along the way, whether personally, financially, emotionally, or giving in-kind services or guiding us as mentors, helping us in so many different ways. And when we had our Kickstarter party, there was no better DJ, let me tell you. We've always wanted to have the right people involved. And so it's like a family. This is for the whole family, the Soul family, we like to call it. There have been people who have been committed to Soul and living a soulful life, whether they knew the Soul show or not. A long time coming.
Hmm. How did you decide that you were going to go the route of Kickstarter at that time?
Kickstarter was a very new platform
right.
back in 2012.
Right.
And it was a great opportunity to push a small piece of content for free. Even as we were raising awareness and raising funds, we were really creating our first audience, because anybody can look at a 2-minute trailer or a 1-minute trailer and then learn a little bit about who you are as people and who's behind the production and possibly get involved with it. That was a really new concept. Crowdfunding hadn't really taken off, especially in the Black community, as early as 2011, 2012, when we did the first one.
Right.
So we were part of that burgeoning idea that people could have a stake in the art they wanted to create. They could feel like they were a part of it. And that's really what we wanted. We wanted people around the world world to be exposed to the soul show itself and the content, but we also wanted to make people feel like this is something that they could be a part of. This is something they could help usher in. That was really what it was all about for us.
Well, that launch party was so amazing in that there were several people who were there, like Loretta Long.
Dr. Loretta Long.
I mean, to me, she's Susan. It was like, oh my goodness, Susan's here from Sesame Street. And Melba Moore was there, and she actually sang Lean On Me.
Lean On Me.
Oh, my goodness.
Thank you.
actually became very sentimental at that time. I got a little misty. It was just being in the moment of like, oh my gosh, this Mr. Soul movie is going to happen. And you had the producer of Soul there.
Yes, Christopher Lucas.
Christopher Lucas.
Kit Lucas.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Did you pretty much put out a call for who would attend the party? Or, you know, it's like, I'm doing this party, could you come? How'd they want
to? Oh, absolutely. You know, we had started developing the project, as I said, way back in 2008.
Right.
And starting from scratch, it's a very unique project in that we had absolutely nothing to start with. We didn't have, you know, a sugar daddy in the back corner. We didn't have any access to money or funding or grants in the beginning. We just had an idea. We didn't have any partners. This is what you call real independent filmmaking.
Right.
It's unusual because usually you don't jump into a giant project. Usually this would be way too ambitious to try to attempt, and it honestly is and was too ambitious to attempt. But I was tired of waiting for someone else to tell the story, and I realized the story was really mine to tell.
Right.
After a certain period of my due diligence and trying to figure out who to align with the project, I realized, well, now it's time to create a public-facing identity for the project and find out who our allies are and get all of our mentors on board and sort of build this little community around this idea. And so everyone was rooting for us. By the time we were ready to put a Kickstarter in place, we had already created a fundraising trailer and we'd already shot several interviews because our first interviews were shot in 2009. So the Kickstarter didn't happen until 2012.
Right.
It's hard to do when you're trying to raise money and you have to raise money to raise money. But
right.
That's really what fundraising is.
Wow. Mr. Soul has been screening at festivals, which brings you to Sugar. There are some upcoming screenings in New York that are happening. You're going to be at Urban World Film Festival on September 21st, and on October 6th, the film is going to screen at the Real Sisters of the Diaspora Film Festival and Lecture Series. Yay!
Yes, so excited. You know, I am all about supporting our sisters and brothers in cinema, and so it really means a lot to us to be able to screen at Urban World on September 21st. That's right in Times Square. It's going to be at 7:15 p.m. at AMC Empire, so I hope y'all can come on out and check that out.
Yes.
And what's really remarkable about that day is it's Ellis Haslip's birthday.
Oh, yay! Oh, my goodness!
So there will be cake.
Uh-oh.
Any excuse for cake, I think.
That is perfect. So people and better act
we'll
fast, by the way. Act fast and get tickets, because
yes, get those
we'll
tickets.
Sell out.
It's not a really big theater. I think there are only 117 seats. So we're going to have a real great party in there and a real great party afterwards.
All right.
And then we're also screening at Real Sisters, which is a wonderful, wonderful festival. And that's going to be up at Columbia University.
Yes, at the Miller Theater, 2960 Broadway on the campus of Columbia University.
I'm really excited to screen at Real Sisters because the Columbia Miller Theater is a beautiful venue. I think it seats like 680. People.
Wow.
So we're going to be reaching out to a lot of film students and regular students and having some special guests in there. So that's going to be a really special screening. And both Sam Pollard and I have screened our works there before. Real Sisters is fantastic, you know. They are really supportive.
I understand you're an alumna. You screened a short there a few
years
back.
Sure did. It was called You're Dead to Me, and we screened it in 2014, and it also received the Real Sisters Best Short Award.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a little love affair with Real Sisters, and so glad that we can come back and share our film there. I think it's going to be wonderful.
Excellent. Before I continue, I want to extend my condolences to you and your family for the transition of your father, Dr. Harold Cornelius Haslip. He transitioned earlier this year in January, and he appears to have been a huge contributor in the accuracy of the telling of this story, as he was there. Could you share his involvement?
He was very, very close to Ellis Haslip. They were like brothers, and they grew up together in the Deanwood section of Northeast Washington, D.C. They lived together right there on Sheriff Road and 48th. For any of our D.C. or DMV family out there, they know where that is. Deanwood was right where Marvin Gaye grew up as well. And so it was a real intimate community. And everything that the family did together really informed Ellis Haslip's life. So I think what really anchors the film, and I don't want to give too many spoilers away, but is the way we can deeply root Ellis Haslip in his Washington, D.C. upbringing, which was so significant to his life and the way he saw the world, and his church upbringing and how that was his first exposure to spirituality and music and theatricality.
Right.
You know, what's interesting is we have to remember it was a different time back then in terms of segregation and Jim Crow laws still being firmly in place. And so the way that people entertained themselves and created their community was around family and around the church. Just like James Baldwin, Ellis Hazlett's early life was very much informed by going to his church and being a part of that community. And you can see all of the spirituality and the gospel, both in the dance that he shares on the show and also the music that he shares and the way he was able to combine gospel and spoken word with Nikki Giovanni and the Truth Is On Its Way album, which
right.
he was instrumental in producing and also wrote the liner notes for.
Master, the tempest is raging, and the billows are tossing high. You see, the sky is all shadowed with blackness.
Was the word, and the word was death, and the word was nigger, and the word was death to all niggers, and the word was death to all life, and the word was death to all peace. Be still. The Genesis was life, the Genesis was death, and the Genesis of death was the Genesis of war. Be still, peace, be still. In the name of peace, they wage the wars. Ain't they got no shame? In the name of peace, Lot's wife is now a product of the Morton Company. No, they ain't got no shame. Noah packing his wife and kiddies up for a holiday. Row, row, row your boat. But why'd you leave the unicorns, Noah, huh? Why'd you leave them? While our black Madonna stood there, 18 feet high, holding him in her arms, listening to the rumblings of peace. Be still. Be still. Can I get a witness? Witness, witness, he wanted to know. And Peter only asked, who is that dude? Who is that black dude? Looks like a troublemaker to me. And the foundations of a mighty, mighty Roman Catholic Church were laid. Hallelujah, Jesus. No, they ain't got no shame. Because they killed the Carthaginians in the great Appian way. And they killed the Moors just to civilize a nation. And they just killed the earth and blew out the sun in the name of a God whose genesis was white. And war wooed God, and America was born, where war became peace, and genocide patriotism, and honor is a happy slave, cause all God's children need rhythm. And glory, hallelujah, why can't peace be still? The great emancipator was a bigot, ain't they got no shame? And making the world safe for democracy were 20 million slaves, no, they ain't got no shame. And they barbecued 6 million to raise the price of beef, and cross the 16th parallel to control the price of rice. Ain't we never gonna see the light? And champagne was shipped out of the East, while kosher pork was introduced to Africa. Only the torch can show the way. In the beginning was the deed, and the deed was death, and the honkies are getting confused. Peace, be still. So the great white prince was shot like a nigger in Texas, and our black shining prince was murdered like that thug in his cathedral, while our nigger in Memphis was shot like their prince in Dallas. And my lord, ain't we never gonna see the light? The rumblings of this peace must be still, be still, be still. Oh, black people, ain't we got no pride?
That all evolved out of the idea that he had to have Nikki Giovanni do her poetry over a live gospel choir, which nobody had done up until that moment.
Right.
We take all these things for granted now because we have so many options, but this really was a beautiful moment in time.
You mentioned in the film how Ellis Hazlip was also involved with the theater before becoming the host of Soul, or becoming the producer of Soul.
Yes, the producer and the host.
Right.
Because initially he was a reluctant host.
Right.
He felt like someone else had to host it and be the impeccable black intellectual that would be inscrutable and couldn't be canceled or something like that. I think that edict came down from the top, from the PBS folks who were trying to figure out what kind of host would be appropriate for a cultural show. But before that, Ellis Hazlip was a prolific theater person and producer, and he had traveled the world to produce shows like Black Nativity and Black New World. Ellis Hazlip had been working as a producer and as a stage manager. It was really hard for him to get work in New York as a black producer in the early 50s and late 50s into the early 60s. Although he did have great success working with Vinette Carroll, the pioneering theater director who created the Urban Arts Corps. Vinette Carroll was actually Broadway's first black woman director.
Wow.
And one of the wonderful shows that he did was Cicely Tyson's first play, I believe, which was Dark of the Moon up at the Harlem YMCA in 1958. All-star cast, James Earl Jones, Roscoe Lee Brown,
wow.
Cicely Tyson, a young Clarence Williams III.
Oh, wow. Who was on the Mod Squad?
And on the Mod Squad. I was waiting for that. I knew you knew.
Yes.
Wasn't it Luke?
Yes, exactly.
One of the most impeccable afros to date.
Hello.
And so Ellis Hazlip was a stage manager for that, and Vinette Carroll really took him under her wing. After that, he went on to form his own production company and produce works all over Europe. And he even worked with people like Marlene Dietrich, produced shows for her and produced shows with different choreographers like Donald McHale. And he also took Alvin Ailey's company out in the very, very beginning of the company when there were just about 6 dancers in it.
Wow.
He was really primed to do a show on television. Ellis had his finger on the pulse of every actor, every producer, every young upstart, and every talent that was ready to be explored on Broadway, off-Broadway, and in theater across the world.
Thank you.
listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar My Bowl is the name of this program. My name is Joyce Jones, and our guest for this evening is producer and director of Mr. Soul, Ellis Hazlip, and The Birth of Black Power TV, Melissa Hazlip. What you're listening to is one of the rare recordings that we're going to be playing during tonight's program, as I had a lot to talk to Melissa Hazlip about with regard to the film, so we're not going to have too much music to play. As a matter of fact, a lot of it's going to be played during this first hour, but what you're listening to in the background is In What Direction Are You Headed? This is Lee Morgan from The Last Session, a 1971 Blue Note Records release. Lee Morgan on trumpet, flugelhorn, Bobby Humphrey on flute, Jimmy Merritt on electric bass, Reggie Workman on acoustic bass, Freddie Waits on drums, Harold Mayburn on electric piano, Billy Harper on tenor saxophone, and Gretchen Moncour III on trombone. Before that, we heard Nikki Giovanni, Great Pax Whitey, from Truth Is On The Way. This was originally recorded in 1971. This is from a 1993 collectibles reissue. Before that, we heard Melba Moore's Lean On Me, and this is from a compilation, The Magic of Melba Moore, A Little Bit More, originally recorded in 1971. This is a 1996 EMI compilation. Before that, we heard Chocolate Buttermilk. That's from Kool and the Gang release, 1970 D-Light Records. Before that, we heard the Mr. Soul trailer, courtesy of YouTube. And before that, we heard Show Me Your Soul, which, as mentioned, has yet to be released, and it will be officially released once there is a national release of the film Mr. Soul by Robert Glasper, featuring the lead vocals of Layla Hathaway, daughter of Donny Hathaway. And of course, we opened our program with our theme from Nina Simone, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl. This is from The Very Best of Nina Simone, Sugar in My Bowl, 1967, 1972. This was originally recorded in 1967. This is from a 1998 RCA BMG compilation. Stay tuned for our On the Bandstand segment with our associate producer, Hank Williams, and more from Melissa Hazlip right here on Sugar in My Bowl. And fair warning, there will not be a lot of music in the second hour. As mentioned, there was a lot to discuss with regard to this film, Mr. Soul. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl continues. Thank you.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for September 16th. This segment features aerial listings of Sugar and My Bowl guests so you can see them live. And this week's guest is filmmaker Melissa Hazlip, director of the documentary Mr. Soul, Ellis Hazlip and the Birth of Black Power TV. There will be screenings at the Urban World Film Festival on September 21st and the Real Sisters of the African Diaspora Film Festival on October 6th, and Hazlip will be at both for question and answer sessions. And we have more listings for you this week. We start with guitarists Bill Frisell and Mary Halverson, who are at Les Poissons Rouges on September 17th. Pianist Harold Mayburn leads a trio at Smalls on the 19th. Pianist Vijay Iyer is at Columbia University's Miller Theater on the 20th. Trombonist and seashellist Steve Turay leads a quintet at Smoke for a CD release party on the 21st and 22nd. Saxophonist Lakeisha Benjamin is at Dizzy's Club from the 21st through the 23rd with Ulysses Owens' big band. Blues vocalist Alexis P. Suter is in downtown Washington, New Jersey for a free outdoor concert on the 22nd. Pianist Mark Carey's Harlem Sessions returns as a Saturday night series with late sets at Smoke on the 22nd and 29th. Vision Fest promoters Arts for Art presents their In Garden series free outdoor concerts in gardens throughout September. And as part of the series, bassist William Parker is at the 6BC Botanical Garden on East 6th Street in Manhattan on the 22nd and at First Street Green on East 1st Street in Manhattan on the 29th. Saxophonist James Brandon Lewis is at First Street Green on the 23rd and vocalist Faye Victor closes out the series at First Street Green on the 30th. Again, those are all part of Arts for Arts' In Garden series. Looking a little further ahead, vocalist Faye Victor is at 55 Bar on the 27th. Guitarist Pat Matheny, bassist Linda Mahon O, and drummer Antonio Sanchez are at Connecticut's Ridgefield Playhouse on the 27th, Morristown, New Jersey's Mayo Performing Arts Center on the 28th, and Long Island's Staller Center for the Arts in Stony Brook on the 29th. Tubist Joe Daly is at Terra Blues with Hazmat Modine on the 29th. Trumpeter Adam O'Farrell is at the Jazz Gallery on the 29th. Vocalist Jasmia Horn is at Hartford, Connecticut's The Artists Collective on the 29th. Saxophonist Claire Daly leads a quartet at Jazz Forum Arts in Tarrytown, New York on the 30th. Vocalist Andy Bay is at the Blue Note on September 30th. Finally, vocalist Dee Dee Bridgewater is at Birdland from October 2nd through 6th. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog, where you'll also find reviews, features, and jazz news. And sugar is spelled S-U-G-A. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are also on the website. And if you're on Twitter and Facebook, look for us there too. We'd appreciate likes, tweets, and shares with your friends. And if you really like what we do, please help the station stay on the air by pledging whatever you can and consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. The support WBAI link on our website has details, and we're grateful for any help you can give the station. This is Hank Williams signing off with our biweekly schedule. We're off the air next week, but we'll have updated event listings online and be back on air on September 30th. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand.
This is Bobby Humphrey. You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
Speaking of theater also, I noticed Barbara Ann Teer was in the film. I can't remember what scene it is, but I remember taking notes that the very African-centered Barbara Ann Teer looked very uncomfortable at some point in the film.
I can tell you, yes. Well, Barbara Ann Teer, the founder of the National Black Theater,
yes,
she was a staple on Soul. Uh-huh. And everything she was doing for the community and for theater and creating a new space and a profound appreciation of blackness and black culture, that would really resonate with Ella Faison. They were kindred spirits. And I was so honored to have Barbara Ann Teer's daughter, Sade Lithcott, in the film to speak on behalf of her mother, because Sade is now carrying on the legacy of her mother, running the National Black Theater up in Harlem.
Right.
And so she really embodied her mother's spirit and her joie de vivre and her love for black culture and really being a transformational vehicle for art and black culture. So Ellis Hazlip had Dr. Barbara Ann Teer on the show many times. One of the times I think you're referring to was the fifth episode of the show. So that would have been October 24, 1968. Wow, we're coming up on that 50th anniversary too. And so the Last Poets were performing.
That's it.
And they were performing live. Now, I have to back this up so I can sort of lay this groundwork for you. We have to remember, this is a live show in 1968, uh-huh, right? Pre-FCC.
Right.
No 7-second delay.
Right.
1 hour with no commercials. So you can imagine that anything was about to go down, and it really couldn't be stopped. And I think that Ellis Hazlip knew that, and so he used that platform to be a little bit seditious and to also create magic, I think. But one of the things he did was he put very radical performers on, and perhaps they weren't radical, but they were perceived as radical.
Right.
Let's make that clarification.
Exactly.
They were just speaking their mind, and they were being free. And where else are you going to have a platform when you're full of rage and no one's there to listen? To have it on Soul was remarkable, because not only was it a vehicle for African-American artistry, but it was a platform for political expression and the fight for social justice. And that was not the trifecta we knew in terms of television, in terms of programming.
Right.
And so it really was radical to have the Last Poets on there.
Walking down on 42nd Street. Heard some white folks talking. Had a riot yesterday. 10 niggas died. Died, nigga. Say what? 10 niggas died. Yeah, died, nigga. Went down to Whitehall Street. Heard a sergeant reporting lots of niggas dying in Vietnam. Die, nigga. Die, nigga. Nigga, die. I had to get away from niggas. Dying all the time. Went back up to Harlem. Heard a school teacher say, niggas sure are dumb. Almost like they're dead. Die, nigga. Everywhere you go, niggas dying. Niggas been dying for 400 years. Niggas dying with conked heads. Niggas dying in Ivy League suits. Niggas know how to die. Been dying for 400 years. Been practicing how to die. Niggas dying in prisons. Niggas dying on farms. Niggas dying in dirty rooms. Even learned how to die in mansions now. Big office buildings. Fancy dying. Niggas love dying. Build big funeral homes so dead nigga undertakers get rich burying dying niggas. Die, nigga. Niggas always trying to die. Niggas get shot. Die, nigga. Niggas get hung. Die, nigga. Niggas get lynched. Die, nigga. Niggas get tarred and feathered. Niggas get boiled in oil. Niggas get carried out of their own homes. Niggas watch their wives get raped. Watch their babies get stomped. Then niggas watch some redneck hunky stand over them and laugh. Laughing, talking about dying, nigga. Actually laughing. Wine bottle in his hand, cigar in his mouth. Laughing, talking about dying, nigga. We're going and dying, nigga. You've been dying for 400 years. Niggas know how to die. Niggas don't know nothing else but dying. Niggas dream about dying. Niggas plan beautiful lives for when they're dead. Die, nigga. Nigga preachers tell niggas about heaven. Got to die first. Die, nigga. Niggas love dying. Niggas watch dying on TV. They love it. Niggas watch other niggas die. They love it. Niggas watched Emmett Till die. Niggas watch Mac Parker die. Niggas watch James Chaney die. Niggas watch Bobby Hutton die. Niggas watch Mega Evers die. Niggas watch niggas die. Niggas watch niggas die. Niggas die. So black folks can take over.
I was talking to Abby O'Doon. He called me up on September the 8th, 2018, and I don't even think he realized it was the 50th anniversary of Soul.
Wow.
And I told him, and he had just written a brand new poem as an ode to Ellis Hayflip, and he read it to me over the phone.
Oh, wow.
And I swear every hair on my head, arms, and neck stood up.
Oh, my goodness.
Because it's so amazing, and all I could think of was they had their first television appearance on Soul in 1968. I think Ellis understood that they needed a platform that was unapologetically black. He said what they were doing was trying to create programs of black love, black strength, black encouragement, and that wasn't what was available on television. All we were seeing was negativity and stereotypes of what black people were in terms of being a nuisance, in terms of the riots that were happening. Well, the riots were happening as a result of the unfair reality of African Americans in our country at that time.
Right.
The riots were a response. The riots were a vocalization demanding equality. Was in response to Martin Luther King's assassination. There was a lot that had to be said at that time. So thank God for Ellis Hayflip to give a space that was both political and communal and intimate in turns to showcase and talk about the importance of the black voice, not just a black voice like singing, but writing and poetry and activism. We can put all those terms on it now, but there really was no terminology for it then. He was really just showcasing black humanity.
There was also something that was like share in the black experience. That was an extension that he offered to the audience to share in the black experience by watching Soul.
Right. By saying that, he was basically saying, we already have this.
Right.
We're good. We know we're beautiful. We don't need the validation. But we have been buked and scorned by the dominant culture, or as we like to say now, the colonizers.
Right.
I think that's a more appropriate term.
Now that people know what it is upon seeing Black Panther.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, Ryan Coogler. What we're seeing is Ellis Hayflip saying, we're out here. We're already here. We've been here.
Right.
But what we're going to do is we're going to share what we have already. We're going to share it with you. It's not here for your judgment. It's not even here for your entertainment. But this is our passionate voice. This is our truth. This is our contribution of black consciousness and black culture. And I think at its core, it was a celebration of blackness because we weren't being celebrated at the time in 1968. Sort of began to evolve, but let's be honest, it really wasn't happening until then. I think that's what made Soul so unique. He didn't need permission from the American mainstream. He just said, this is our culture. It's rich, it's beautiful, and we'll share it with you if you want to tune in, but it's already happening. I think it was that audacity and that boldness that really makes this such a shock to see, because nowadays we have to ask permission for all of that. We don't have that kind of outlet.
And that was something I was also wondering. I remember hearing you say this somewhere, but I'm going to ask you, do you think that there could be a Soul today?
Absolutely. I do think there could. I think it would be difficult.
Yeah.
Let me rephrase that. I think there should be.
Right.
I know we're not supposed to use that term because it implies negativity, but I think there could be and there should be, because I really think there needs to be a platform for black excellence.
Mm-hmm.
To be welcomed
right.
and unquestioned and undiluted. That's what was so interesting about Soul and so terrifying to many people, was that it was undiluted and unapologetically black. Folks weren't ready.
Well, I'm also thinking of the participants, the artists that were showcased on Soul, a lot of them were not afraid to express themselves.
Absolutely.
Now, today, I don't know that they're... Actually, I'm reminded of Harry Belafonte. In the closing statements during the credits, I'm jumping ahead, but since we're talking about this... Well, at one point, he had called out Beyonce and Jay-Z, but there's a statement that he makes that reminded me of that in the closing of Soul about artists needing to be more than just performers. I'm not quite sure how we, gosh, I wish I had the exact quote here.
Oh, I have it. So Harry Belafonte, we were able to interview him in 2012, and he was on The Soul Show in an episode with Sidney Poitier, and they were talking about their film that they had just completed together, Buck and the Preacher.
Yes.
And their hopes and dreams about being able to be Black men and women who have evolved as artists to become directors, evolving from Step and Fetch It all the way up to Mantan Moreland and all the way up through Sidney Poitier and Harry Belafonte. And in his interview, he speaks so eloquently, and I never wanted to interrupt him, so I would let him go on for 5, 10, 15 minutes at a time. And one of the most cogent things he says that we do include in the film is he's talking about the journey of a people and what artists have to do, the conflict that artists have about being anointed and having so much financial compensation at the end, and that makes their journey reckless. But then he says, but what happened to art? What happened to the voices that bring balance? Those seem to have eluded us. I hope it's just a momentary thing. But certainly, had we more Ellis Hazlips today, more men and women of that fabric, with that kind of gift, with that kind of passion, with that kind of quest for truth, I think by and large, America and the world would be a better place in which to reside.
That's it.
And the best thing about that is I knew the moment he said that, that would be the end of the film. I had no idea how the film was going to start, but I knew on that day in 2012, I knew that I had found the end of my film. And what we did was we had a hard time getting everything into the film because we shot so many amazing interviews, and then we had to choose from such rich archival materials, both from the Soul episodes, of which there were 130, and also sort of the zeitgeist, the archival history of what was happening for the Black people in our culture. And one of the things that Belafonte does, which I loved, was that he decided at that moment, after he'd said that most beautiful gem, that the interview was over indeed.
Right.
He literally says, you don't get an ending better than that.
Right.
This is over.
And the great thing is that it is showing during the credits, so it's perfect.
And I had to put it in because I knew I was so tickled and so intimidated and so excited all at the same time. But I knew, first of all, he's the greatest elder statesman of art culture that we have at the moment. Of course, we have Sidney Poitier, but he is not as vocal. He's not as out there as he is a little more fragile at the moment. But to be able to sit down with Harry Belafonte and have him speak about the journey of our people and our art and our promise and our challenges, it was the greatest privilege of my life. And certainly to do it in the context of Ellis Hazlip was even more spectacular. So yeah, there are some real gems that we were able to record, and we still hope to get one or two more interviews that we would hope to be able to capture before the film goes into distribution.
Oh, wow.
I won't tell you what those are because okay, that's a secret. But trust and believe that they were on Soul, and we have a lot of people who are phenomenal artists. They may have been lesser known or unknown at the time, but now they're all famous. So we have to work out people's schedules and figure out how to get people to sit down for an interview with us. And that's been part of the reason it took so long to complete the film. It's just honoring artists and their schedules and their availability.
And you're reading that quote from Harry Belafonte. It once again brings me back to your believing that there could be a Soul. Do you think there are actually artists who have the same, I don't know, fortitude that the artists were exhibiting then?
I think so. Okay. And you know, what's happened is we're living in a different time, mm-hmm. but we have the same movement, the same push behind us. We have the same need to be activists, and we have to have agency in our own lives, and we must tell our own stories.
Right.
And so I think that artists today find their challenge in that they have to remain commercially viable, and they need to make money, and they need to have sponsorships. And sometimes that might curb people's ability to speak freely. But I think if we were to have a platform like Soul, where people were free to be themselves and to just have an opportunity to show their Black excellence and to be received and perceived correctly, I think that would take off like crazy.
I want to get back to people involved in the film.
Sure.
I mentioned earlier the shared directing credit that Sam Pollard has. He most recently worked on Maynard and I've Got to Be Me, the Sammy Davis Jr. film. I guess the person on a documentary that really stands out for me, in addition to the directors, is the editor.
Yeah.
time?
We had three amazing editors working on our film. Three completely different styles, three different people with three different visions that showed up at different points of our edit and really helped us start, gave us the structure in the middle, and then finished it. So we had a wonderful editor by the name of Giovanni Autran, and then we had an editor named Anuka Lilia, and then our last editor who helped us over the finish line is Blair McClendon. And Blair is a young brother who was really fantastic. All the editors were fantastic. They'd worked on features. Giovanni had worked on The Time, the Khalif Browder story, which was really provocative on Spike TV.
Mm-hmm.
And then Anuka had worked on an amazing film on Bill Nye, the Science Guy.
Oh, yes.
She was just perfect in terms of finding the biographical and the really emotional center of our character. And then Blair McClendon had worked on a film called Who Streets.
Oh, yes.
About the Black Lives Matter movement, about Mike Brown in Ferguson. And Blair is also a teacher. He teaches graduate school editing at NYU. And he'd had several award-winning films and shorts that had opened at Cannes and had opened at Sundance. And he'd done a lot of work as a contributing editor during the labs at Sundance, not as an editor that needed to be mentored, but a mentoring editor himself. And so when we met, it was just kismet. And he really helped us get to the finish line. So really, really loved this young brother. We got together and he was just the energy and the vision we needed. And I was in the edit room every day and we worked in shifts. So we had an editor that would come in from 10 to 6 and we had an editor that would come in from 6 to 10. And then sometimes an editor would come in from 10 to 2 or 3 in the morning as we prepped the final finishing days of editing. But we edited for well over a year.
Wow.
It was really important to find our story and to be economic with our storytelling.
So how did you decide that the material that you chose? Did you map out the tale that you wanted to tell and have it coincide with that?
We sure did. What we did was fairly unique and very ambitious, but it was completely necessary to tell our story. We created three different storylines. So in filmmaking, we might call it a storyline. Also, we might call it a string out. So what we did was we created three separate sequences or three separate string outs, which corresponded with three different storylines. We had the storyline A, which was the story of Ellis Hazlett. Now, we weren't doing a cradle-to-grave documentary,
right,
but we're dropping in on these 5 years of Soul from 1968 to 1973. So we wanted to know who he was in those 5 years. Plus, we needed a little backstory to understand where he came from and a little future story to know where he went after Soul. So that's storyline A. Then storyline B is a story of Soul itself. So first we had the biography of the man, now we're going to do the biography of the show. So we took the string out, or the sequence, if you will, of the five seasons of Soul, from its inception to its heyday to its cancellation and demise, against a backdrop of a quickly shifting political landscape. And what we did was we found the most important episodes and appearances and performances that we couldn't live without. The somewhat greatest hits of Soul, or the essential Soul, we called it. And we mapped that out over 5 years. Then storyline C was the zeitgeist, or the story of the nation. What was happening to contextualize African-American culture from 1968 to 1973. And then what we had to do was look at all three storylines, and we could watch them separately as three different movies or three different sequences or three different string outs, and they went on forever, as you can well imagine. Okay, now we know the story we're telling. Can we collapse all three and come up with one storyline? And we lined up all the salient points from storyline A, B, and C. We had a giant wall full of 3x5 index cards listing every single thing, transitions, songs, and the performers, the zeitgeist, the archival clips, and everything was in the same sequence. So we understood from 68 to 73 what was happening, whether it was the Vietnam War or the women's movement or Martin Luther King's assassination as a launching point for the tumult that was happening in America. So that became the really big challenge. Can we tell this story? Can we be economic with it? Can we find the salient pieces, and will everything earn its way into the film? And that was the challenge. It's a really unusual way to build a film, but that's the way I wanted to tell a story. And it was not easy, I'll tell you that.
Now, there are certain things that we're not going to get into here. There are certain points in Ellis Haslip's life, his sister Janet being a big part of it, and his being a gay man, and how he was embraced in his family as opposed to being kicked out.
Absolutely. It's really important to recognize that Ellis Haslip was unapologetically gay as
right.
well, at a time when it was very difficult. Let's just remember, it was difficult to be black in America, let alone to be black and gay.
Right.
And to be a public figure and not be ostracized, because we just weren't an inclusive society then. Same-gender loving people were ostracized, and both black culture and mainstream culture did not embrace that. Really makes his personality that much more bold and innovative and fearless. I actually put those on a post-it that stayed in front of my room where I was working out of my production office for about 5 years, to be bold and fearless. Because that's what I think of when I think of Ellis Haslip. Here's this man who has no precedent for him in the culture on television. And what he's doing is he's bringing the audience, not only black culture, but the many layers of black culture, the complexity of black culture, the plurality of black identity. And it's a brother who happens to be gay himself. So he's living many dualities in terms of the expectations of him and what he's allowed to bring forth. And so I think it's really remarkable. And we wanted to explore that side of him organically, because that's who he was. And I think it's very important that we do that in a manner that was commensurate with the way it was done at the time, because we speak very differently now about our gender politics and how we wear that on our sleeve or don't. But it was not the same. It was not as free back then. And so that became a challenge. How do we accurately, lovingly, and respectfully, with integrity, share this man in a way that would be appropriate for the time in which he grew up and for what he would want us to know, and to give him this sort of transcendent status at the same time, but to show the humanity of him. That was always our goal, and I hope that that shows up in the film, because that was our intention, to create a story out of love and transparency and urgency, especially. But not just how we mapped out the story of a people, but the story of this man, and how he placed his unique stamp on the black culture and was able to bring such treasured interviews and talent and rhetoric against a political backdrop. It's hard to have all of those elements during the dawning of the Vietnam War, and of course Nixon's hard stance against the black inner city disguised as a stance against drugs.
Right.
It's really hard to adapt all of that, and I think it's pretty remarkable what Ellis Haslip did, and I'm really happy to be able to share this story now. I think we need it now. We need to be reminded that we've always been great, because there's always something bigger and grander going on, and Ellis Haslip is all about the long game.
We've talked about Nixon. I don't want to say exactly what is shared, but there is some audio. There are some tapes. How did you get your hands on that?
Okay, this is tricky because I don't want to give a spoiler. I'll say this. What's interesting about the film was that we didn't have to look too far to find a nemesis. We had Nixon. So we all know that Nixon was a nemesis, not only of freedom of speech and PBS and anything that was radical or progressive, but he also had it out for black folks. We can say that now looking back, but of course disguising his war against poverty and crime and drugs was really a war against the black community. So it was very easy, because we knew that having this thread of the nemesis of Nixon would help us contrast what the black voice was saying and what the voice of America was saying. And this sort of followed our theme of the dualities that we were showing and the complexities of black life and what everybody was up against. So we had to do a lot of research and find some unusual things, and we plumbed the depths of the Nixon Library in California in order to get some really great smoking guns out of there. But that's all I'm going to say about that.
That's it. That's right. If you want to know, you have to see the film. Were you aware of Soul growing up?
Absolutely. I was aware of Soul because I was very close to my Uncle Ellis Haslip, and he was actually living with us when the show was being filmed. Of course, I was way too young to really understand what he was doing, but I knew that there was something magical about him. We were living on the Upper West Side on West End and 80th Street, and even though he had his own apartment on Fifth Avenue, he decided he wanted to live with his Soul brother, Harold Haslip. So he moved in with us. The benefit of that was pretty spectacular, because after he would do the tapings, he would bring home some of the guests from the show. Now, I didn't know then that I was bouncing on James Earl Jones's knee, or that Clifton Davis was pinching my cheek, or that I was running around underneath the kitchen table with Malcolm X's children, because the only way Ellis Hazel could get Betty Shabazz to come out, after, of course, the unfortunate assassination of her husband, was to bring her children along. So I had no idea that all of this was happening, but I knew there was something magical about him. And so I watched him very carefully, and we had a very close kinship, and I knew that he had magical people around him. Little did I know that they would be some of the greatest African-American icons of the 20th century. Melba Moore, Clifton Davis, Novella Nelson became a very dear friend. Anna Maria Horsford became a very dear friend. Also, Harold Hayslip, with my father, was also the host of Soul in the beginning, when they were trying to find a host.
Right.
And Ellis Hazlip was a reluctant host because he had a lot on his plate as producer. And so he didn't want to be out front. He really wanted to push gently from behind and give a platform to all the artists without compromising what he felt was the show. As I grew older and I got to work with him because he allowed me to produce with him, I started to realize that he had created this extraordinary repository of Black culture in all the 130 episodes that he'd done.
Wow.
And I always thought, why don't they bring that back?
Mm-hmm.
We could use something like that.
Yes.
And it always nagged me, because I thought, you know, Ellis was not a myth. He was a real man. He was always down to earth. He was never floating above with the celebrities on a different frequency. He was real.
So why isn't it brought back?
For the people, by the people. That's a very good question. You know, I can't answer why, but I can tell you what I'd like to see happen. I hope that the film and the interest that the film brings to the series will generate enough excitement, interest, and desire to see the episodes again, that we might be able to reignite an interest in Soul and possibly a re-release. I think that would be spectacular.
There's a limited amount of episodes available on the Channel 13 PBS website.
That's correct. It's called PBS Passport, but you have to be a member of PBS to view them. Or the episodes used to be free, but now they're behind a paywall. It's like a membership perk to have PBS Passport to see the episodes there. I think that the episodes should be available to all.
Right.
And you don't have to be a researcher and go to the Smithsonian like I did, or the National Archives, or everybody's house that used to work on the show.
Right.
Or digging through the vaults of every repository of vintage television and every collection I could find, especially in educational sources and libraries. It really should be out there. So I'm really hoping, praying, and believing that the interest and the exposure from the film will create a new era where Soul can be reborn.
You and I face. My life, I found someone that may not be here forever to see me through. But I found strength in you. I only pray that I've shown you a brighter day, because that's all that I am living for. You see, don't worry what happens to me. Cause in my mind, you will stay here always, and love you and I, you and I, you and I.
Now, the camera work, now I can use as an example a dance scene with Alvin Ailey to Stevie Wonder's You and I. There's like a sort of overlapping of movement. It's like a double exposure of sorts. I'm not quite sure what the language is. One movement going on in the foreground and another of the same people going on in the background. That was a technique that was used during Soul. Are any of those techniques something that helped you as you're a filmmaker now?
Absolutely. You know, I'd like to give credit where credit's due. And that unique dance sequence, which was choreographed by the great George Faison,
yes,
who's also featured in our film, who originally choreographed The Wiz and has contributed so much to our culture. And Stevie Wonder is singing You and I live.
Right.
And then the cinematography, the way it's directed, that was conceived by none other than Stan Lathan.
Oh.
Stan Lathan was one of the first directors on the show. And Stan was really unique. He had been doing a show out of WGBH in Boston called Fay Brother. And then he was brought to New York to also do a little directing on Sesame Street. And Ellis kind of poached him to come be on Soul because he was excited to have the vision of a young black director and wanted to give him an opportunity, because Ellis was always doing that. It was always about an inclusive crew. We see what Ava DuVernay is doing, having women and all people,
yes,
of color on her crews and all her women directors. It's really spectacular that Ellis Haslip was thinking ahead as an Afrofuturist.
That's right.
And was putting together opportunities and offering crew positions for people who weren't really able to work in network television like that, certainly not in public television. So here comes Stan Lathan, and he really cut his chops and honed his skills as a director. He also fell in love with the dance and created what would be a very long relationship of the camera and dance. And he went on to do some wonderful specials that Stan Lathan directed and was the visual director for, the director of photography that Ellis Haslip produced. Those were specials that became sort of the quintessential Alvin Ailey specials. And he really had an eye for treating the whole dancer, the aura of the dancer and the spirit and the movement, in a very unique way. And that became a trademark for his directing. The thing about Soul, and one of the reasons it was so inspiring to do this film, is we realized what they were doing doing was so cutting edge for their time. That upped our game significantly. We realized, wow, our cinematography game has to be strong. Not only does it have to be sort of commensurate in 2018 for what they were doing 50 years ago, it has to be equally as visually dynamic, equally as provocative, if not more so. Of course, we have technology on our side, but we didn't want the film to just be your typical clips and heads in terms of a historical documentary where you see something, you say something about it, then you see it again.
Right.
We didn't want to have that. This is not your grandma's documentary, you know. We wanted it to be progressive. I know some grandmas are progressive.
Exactly.
So don't get me wrong. I'm not an ageist here. I'm just saying. Here we were looking at this footage, which was so transformational for its time and so daring, so experimental, so beautiful, colorful, and dynamic. And we were thinking, okay, so that's what they did in 68. How can we do that now? How can we make the film look as gorgeous and as unexpectedly beautiful and unapologetically black? And we succeeded in that, I think, especially with the talents of Hans Charles, who is a really dynamic individual and a wonderful man and a beautiful cinematographer. Hans, you would recognize because he was a cinematographer on Ava DuVernay's documentary, The 13th, which was really, really beautiful and really arresting in its composition. Then we decided that we were going to shoot with 3, 4, and 5 cameras sometimes.
Wow.
Or sometimes 2 cameras and a handheld, and to put a dolly down, like a 12-foot Dana dolly, so we would have a second camera that was moving. So all of this choreography and ideas, all of that collaboration came out of the impetus of the original soul being so fierce. Like, well, how are we going to top that? I hope we rose to that challenge.
I just want to let people know the name of your production company. It's Shoes in the Bed.
Yes.
And I'm not going to give it away, but the name comes out of a story that was told during the course of this film.
It does. I'm not going to give away the story, but I will tell you the analogy. Shoes in the bed is something we all know we shouldn't do. And especially in black culture, you know you're not supposed to have those shoes on now. Come on now. So there's certain things you just do not do. It's bad if you do them.
Right.
And you're going to be told that you can't do them and that you won't do them. And this sort of correlates to a story that's told about Alice Hazup in the film. But when I heard the story told for the first time, it was like a light bulb went off. And this is in 2009 when I was just forming the company. And I was like, that's it. That's going to be the name of the company, because I'd been told for years that I'd never be able to make this film, that it was too ambitious, that I should wait for some senior person like Ken Burns to come along and do it.
You know?
It was too much culture and too much history and too much to be responsible for, the story of all these artists, the story of our people, that the rights would be a bear and that it would just be impossible to do. And I was like, yep. You're right. Absolutely. And I'm going to go ahead and do it anyway.
Yay.
There were times when I regretted that decision. Now, here we are after 10 years, and I stuck with it. And I want to thank all of our amazing team, our families, the people who didn't stay with us but had to move on, and, of course, the people that we interviewed and the people and the artists who have left us and joined the ancestors, and especially our supporters, our funders. We got some major funding from the Black Public Media, which used to be called National Black Programming Consortium. They're kind of the watchdogs for diversity on PBS. And from the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities, that's government money now. That's government cheese. Having that kind of stamp on the project was remarkable. Also, the Ford Foundation came in and helped us finish, and we got money from ITVS and grants from the International Documentary Association, the IDA, the Puffin Foundation, and the Awesome Foundation, also known as the Harnish Foundation. And what was really important was that we have the film be publicly funded, because the provenance of the project was always equal to the beginning and the pedigree of the show. The series was the first show created for Black people by Black people on television, this kind of show with an all-Black cast and an all-Black production team and producers. That hadn't happened yet. And it was the strength of the people, and by the support from the people who watched and the in-studio audience and the home audience, that kept Soul running. It was a community. So we figured, well, that has to be the pedigree for our film, too. We want it to be funded publicly. We want to be completely transparent, and we want to feel like people have a stake in it. So we're grateful to all of our Kickstarter funders and all the funders, the people who donated. We didn't even have enough room on our credits, but we're going to do the credits one more time.
Oh, my.
And get everybody's names in there. We didn't have enough room because the credits were so long, so we had to abbreviate them for the festival version. The irony is the festival version is really long. long and the credits are shorter than they should be.
Oh.
So I hope when we finish the film and get a distributor, we'll be able to even it all out. And so anybody, if you don't see your name out there, don't get mad. We know who you are and we appreciate you. Mad love to the people out there.
I'm surprised that this isn't the final version.
One of the things that we have to remember is that it's an intense, rights-heavy production. The rights to the music,
right.
The publication of the music, the publishing of the music. There's so much music. There's so much content, and there's so much intellectual property. So everything has to be paid for. So a lot of that has been an ongoing process. All the rights have been completed. But when we first premiered, we didn't have the names of all of the songs in our credit list. So when we finish the film for distribution, the credits will be impeccable, and we'll have the names of all the songs, and we'll be able to add and make any kind of changes that we need to.
I got it. I understand that also has to do with the fact that why Soul is not had a rebroadcast because of license and stuff like that.
Yes. You know, it's a funny thing, licensing, because on the one hand, the show was performed live, and that was a plus because it meant that when the performers were doing a song or doing a spoken word piece, they weren't actually lip syncing. They were performing it live, and that's a different kind of license because you don't have to go back. I know this is sort of insider baseball on licensing and clearances.
Yay.
It's a different type of license that you have to pay for. So you're not going back and paying for the original song that was recorded at Stax Studios or something. You're paying for the publishing rights of the song, and you're paying for the right to use the song as it's being performed on the show. So in a way, that helps us out tremendously. And it's really important to me when we think about what's happened to artists over the years and artists not getting paid.
Right.
We make sure every single artist gets paid.
Excellent.
The problem is that a lot of musicians have lost their publishing rights, and so the rights go to the publishers and the funds go to the publishers. But
right.
That's another conversation.
Right.
So PBS has certain rights that they can use when they are broadcasting on PBS across the PBS stations. But when you're doing something that's theatrical, that's a different license. If you're screening in a theater, that's a different type of license. If you're showing on TV or if streaming, like say Netflix or even an educational distribution, say to colleges or libraries, each one is a different type of license. And so you have to be really specific about the license that you are requesting and the amount of time you want it for.
Got it. You know, I actually,
yes, it's quite ambitious that way.
I also noticed that while I was preparing to talk to you, that the King Curtis opening theme for Soul doesn't seem to exist as a recording. It seemed to only be specifically for Soul. Is that true?
That is right.
Okay.
That is a great piece of trivia. Yes, King Curtis was a remarkable artist, and he was the musical director of the show, and he wrote the song that became the Soul theme song specifically for Soul. It was not recorded for any other purpose, and it was never performed in any other venue or circumstance. So it was very unique.
Wow.
And he was beloved as the musical director of Soul. Unfortunately, he died. He was killed.
Right.
And so things changed after that, and they had to sort of regroup. And Ellis started having a lot of artists host the Soul show, including Curtis Mayfield, which is really unusual.
Huh.
And he would put artists on that you wouldn't expect would speak. But Ellis knew that everybody had an opinion and deserved to be heard. So there were a lot of unusual guest hosts. He also had the Iceman, Jerry Butler, hosting several shows as well.
Now, I noticed some radio personalities who are known locally. Jerry Bledsoe was one.
Yes.
From
Jerry
WWRL.
Dean.
Yes.
Jerry Bledsoe from WWRL. Absolutely.
And I understand that Imhotep, Gary Bird, was actually one of the hosts as well.
Yes, he was. Gary Bird, you can hear his voice a couple of times in the film.
There's exactly.
What's remarkable about Soul is that there were so many phenomenal musicians and artists and activists on the show. It's hard to imagine that they were all in one place over the course of 5 years, but just think about who they had. There was Donny Hathaway, Tito Puente, Hugh Masekela, Nikki Giovanni, Sonia Sanchez, James Baldwin, the writers. But also there was Miriam Makeba and Novella Nelson. And he also showcased jazz, which was so important. So you'd have Thelonious Monk and his son, T.S. Monk Jr., or Max Roach, with Mboom, which was really remarkable. And then he would have classic soul R&B artists like Gladys Knight and the Pips, Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, B.B. King, Black Ivory, Kool and the Gang. My goodness, the list goes on. Staple Singers, the Nightlighters. It was just remarkable. The Delphonics, Melba Moore, Roberta Flack, Bill Withers, Mary Clayton. It's just astonishing that some of these people were on television for the first time. Remember that Earth, Wind & Fire for the first time. Roberta Flack for the first time, and even Al Green for the first time. It's just remarkable that Ellis had this eye for talent and who was going to be extraordinary and who was going to build the soundtrack of our lives.
Yeah, that would be Al Green in a very hot turtleneck.
Yes, or a very hot Al Green, depending
right,
on how you look at
right.
it.
Right, exactly. You know, Christian McBride told me that Cannonball Adderley had done one of the shows as well.
Yes. So one thing that Ellis knew was that jazz was cutting edge. He knew that black culture led. It didn't pull, as the wonderful Felipe Luciano, the last poet, says in the film. And so there's a show called The Blue Note Show. It was an episode that was devoted entirely to jazz artists. And it was remarkable that all of these artists were on the show. He had Horace Silver. He had the vocalists, sister and brother team, Andy Bay and Salome Bay. He had Lee Morgan on there almost a month before he died. He had the flautist Bobby Humphrey, Cecil Bridgewater. So these were artists that you would never see on television because jazz was not an established art form as perceived by the dominant culture. We knew it was established, but it didn't have a platform. So he had Billy Taylor on there talking about jazz and playing with the Billy Taylor Trio. Billy was on the very first episode in 1968. So Ellis was always on the cutting edge with music, and one of my favorite tiny piece of trivia, that even Spike Lee's father was on there.
Bill Lee.
Did you know that Bill Lee was on there? Yes, with the New York bass violin choir. And the only person who would know about that probably would be Spike Lee. He would have that. Then he'd have Little Jimmy Scott, or he'd have Junior Walker and the All-Stars. And he also had the McCoy Tyner Quartet. Just spectacular. Everyone from Odetta to Umoja to Betty Shabazz, Bobby Hebb, and Ron Carter, which was really fantastic. So it was really remarkable in terms of the jazz ensemble that he had.
Wow. 2 points that I want to make before we get off this phone. There's one, and I need clarification on here. Under the very special thanks credit, you credit the Afro.
Yes. That's the Afro, which is the newspaper in Washington, D.C.
Okay. Because I was thinking... Because you actually go into the film about the afros that are worn during the soul program. So I thought you were actually faking the hairstyle.
Well, you know what? That would be accurate, actually. I would like to thank the Afro as an institution for being, as Greg Tate states, an expression of follicle militancy.
Hey!
Hey! Shout out to Greg Tate.
Now, the last thing I want to cover. I was sort of looking around YouTube, and I stumbled across something. It's a performance by you from The Dark Star from Harlem, a musical tribute to Josephine Baker. This was a 1990
How did you find that?
La Mama Theater performance. It is on YouTube.
I hope the whole thing isn't on YouTube.
Not the whole thing, just a segment. You're an actress, huh?
Well, I'm not an actress now. I have been in the past. Right. Right now, I'm really focusing on producing, directing, and writing.
Okay.
And I kind of hung up my acting, dancing shoes many years ago. So this is a second act for me.
Okay.
But I do come out of theater. I was classically trained both as a dancer and an actor and really felt like that was my expression. And so I was in musical theater and I was a Broadway performer for many years.
Wow.
I also toured nationally and internationally with a lot of wonderful productions, but I ultimately felt like I didn't want to be the center of attention anymore in front of the camera. I found it much more interesting to be behind the camera and to find a way to create, to be more masterful in the creation of a vision and a story for a director. Naturally, coming from performing, I understood the arts quite fully, and that's always been my first love, dancing and singing and acting. But I also wanted to tell a larger story and to be a vehicle for emerging voices. And so that's why I created my company, Shoes in the Bed Productions, because I felt like there were so many diverse voices and diverse stories that needed to be told. And if I could step out from the performing aspect of it that I could really shepherd new projects. And so it was a natural transition. I went to Los Angeles and I worked in development at AFI, and I started to see how Hollywood was working, and I had transitioned into acting. It just felt like a natural next step to have the vision of a director and then to produce with a director.
You created the short that was featured at Real Sisters Film Festival, and now this is your second work? How many films
have you done? I've done about 5 short films.
Okay.
5 experimental films and short films and art films.
Okay.
And 1 narrative short. But this is my first time producing a feature-length documentary, producing and directing.
Exactly.
So in a sense, it is my first feature all around. I've worked on many features before as an actor and as a sort of below-the-line talent. I've helped friends, and I've also been a casting director. Sort of worked my way up through casting to help create and deliver the vision of the director. And then that was the next natural step to being a director and producer.
Kudos to you for doing a job well done and having a great team help you make it happen. And remind people that the upcoming screenings, the first one is Friday, September 21st at Urban World Film Festival. And the second one is October 6th at Real Sisters of the Diaspora Film Festival and Lecture Series. And you can find out more from Urban World. Actually, I think you have the screenings on your site. Did I say that?
Yeah,
yes.
And also we on all our social media, too.
Yes.
You can find us at Mr. Soul the Movie. We're on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter.
Yes.
And so we're constantly updating everything we're doing. We have to update our website because we built it way back when you couldn't write on your own website, so it's a little bit old. So we're doing an overhaul of that. But in the meantime, you can catch up with us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter.
Yes. Yes, and I'm connected with you on all 3 platforms.
And yes,
you can
indeed.
You can actually see your festival journey at these locations as well.
You know, we're just so excited to bring the film to the people via festivals because sometimes that's the best way to just meet real people and show it to the community. Eventually, we would like to, and soon, we hope, have a distribution deal in place, and that will put us on a larger platform, and then also have international distribution as well, and we'll be able to play in theaters and hopefully have VOD, SVOD, streaming. And
video on demand, for those who may not know.
I'm sorry.
No,
yes.
No.
I'm so used to all the acronyms here. Yes, video on demand, streaming on demand, and of course, just streaming, like a streaming platform like Netflix or Hulu or something like that. You know, what's changing so much is the way people receive their content.
Right.
And so a lot of people aren't going to the theaters anymore, so we have to adapt to that as well. People watch on their mobile, on their tablets, on their laptops.
Right.
It's a very diverse and changing world in terms of technology, and we're trying to keep up.
However, I would suggest that people stay connected and catch a screening on a bigger screen near you as soon as it's available, because it's such a wonderful story, and it is definitely long overdue and high time, and yay, I'm glad it's here. Thank you so much, Melissa Hanslip, for this work.
Thank you so much, Joyce. We're so honored to be able to sit down and chat with you and share this with New York and our home base and our people and celebrate Ellis Hanslip, who was a true New Yorker.
You were perfect. Everything you said was perfect. Even the corrections were perfect. Even your errors were correct.
I am so divine.
Right.
Don't get me started on these divine.
Well, thank you so much. Melissa Hanslip.
It's been a pleasure, and thank you for pursuing me for so long and trying to make it happen. Bye.
Peace.
And you're listening to the closing moments of Sugar in My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones, and what you're listening to in the background is Way Back Home from the Jazz Crusaders. This is from their 1970 Chisa Records release, Old Socks, New Socks, New Socks, Old Socks. This is a Wilton Felder composition. Wilton Felder is also on tenor saxophone. Joe Sample on piano, Wayne Henderson on trombone, and Styx Hooper on drums. Before that, we heard You and I, We Can Conquer the World, from Stevie Wonder's 1972 Tamla Motown Records release, Talking Book. And before that, we heard Die Nigger, from The Last Poets from their Right On release, 1971 Douglas Records. Many thanks to Melissa Hayslip for the time that she spent with us to share her journey with Mr. Soul, the movie. And don't delay in getting tickets for Urban World, because, as mentioned, it is a smaller venue. This is definitely a film worth seeing. Sugar in My Bowl shall return on Sunday, September 30th. Stay tuned for La Nueva Alternativa, which is scheduled next, right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Stay tuned.
Hello, bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.